Peace out, Cub Scouts. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. We are thrilled to have you with us. It is a very snowy morning. I just learned in riding on my commute. I was just telling Ian Pickus that I had listened to All Things Considered all night, all afternoon and into the evening last night. And for some reason, during the numerous weather forecasts, never picked up the fact that it was going to be really snowy on my way in this morning. But anyway, we're here and we're ready to go. We have a great show for you. At least it looks good on paper. Let me tell you why it looks good on paper. We have some amazing panelists with us. Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. I walked this morning. There was no hint of snow. I got home. I had to take Murray the dog out, and down it came.
Yeah.
And there it is.
Yeah.
And Joe, if I can just make one comment, I want to say this, and that is that all reports are that you are one great teacher. And, of course, we know that St. Rose is having a big problem right now, and I know that they're not going to have you. And I have to say, that is a big mistake. Can you imagine having Joe Donahue as your teacher? Whoa.
Yeah,
that's all
well,
I gotta say on that.
You know, I thank you, Alan. I've been there 12 years or so, and who
wow.
knows? And who knows? Our paths may cross again. I am just a lowly adjunct, but who knows? But a lot of our colleagues lost their positions and almost a third, and it's a sad story, but it's one that's being replicated across the country, and I'm sure we can discuss it this morning and talk about it. But it's
they've got one tough lady at the helm there, Marcia White, who I love,
who is an alum and is doing a really good job, and I think the best she can, and that's good. And I would just since you mentioned it, and I was not planning on it, but since you did, let me just say I love working with you because this is now my only job.
You're safe, bro. You're safe.
Okay. Well, good morning and welcome, Alan. Good to have you here. Bob Griffin is with us as well. He is the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security at the University at Albany, an ever-safe position, I am sure. Bob, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. And it would be a good topic to talk about because it has enormous implications, not just in our own region, but nationally as well. Before we go on, Joe, I know I'm a little bit early, but since I'm not going to be on Friday, I just want to wish everybody a happy Hanukkah. I hope they have a safe and blessed Hanukkah this year, considering all of the adversity that we've experienced. So anybody listening who celebrates, my thoughts and prayers are with you.
Thank you. That is very, very nice of you, Bob. And we also welcome to the program Times Union columnist Chris Churchill. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. I hope everybody had a really happy Safe Harbor Day yesterday.
You know, well, I think that's still to be determined, isn't it?
Yeah.
To see how safe our Safe Harbors are.
It wasn't a white Safe Harbor Day, but we got it the day after.
I'm dreaming of a white Safe Harbor Day. Yeah. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist, UAlbany. You're an adjunct professor. Good for you. You held on.
I am. I am for a little while longer. Yes, it's hard out there. It's very tough. I'm hoping the show goes quickly today. I have today is cookie making day. I'm going to sit out my kitchen, looking out the deck at snow and baking all day.
Well, I don't know how quickly it's going to go, but it'll be over at 10:50.
That's not enough time.
All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome. A reminder, actually, I am telling some of you for the first time, you can be a part of our program. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. It's really very important that we hear from you. So let's go to a very interesting story, I think. It was one that was not a big surprise, but we sort of talked about it a lot on the show as a possibility. And yesterday, the Supreme Court made it clear they denied the allies of President Trump and their bid to overturn election results, in this case in the state of Pennsylvania. The Supreme Court on Tuesday denied the last-minute attempt by President Trump's allies to overturn the election results in Pennsylvania, a blow to the president's continuing efforts to reverse his loss to Democrat Joe Biden. The court's brief order denying a requested injunction provided no reasoning, nor did it note any dissenting votes. It was the first request to delay or overturn the results of last month's presidential election to reach the court, and it appears that Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Trump's latest nominee, took part in the case. The lawsuit was part of a blizzard of litigation, and personal interventions that Trump and his lawyers have waged to overturn victories by Biden in a handful of key states. Alan, you've been worried about this for a long time. Are you feeling
Every
any
day.
Better?
No. I don't know what this guy is up to, and I know one thing. Whatever it is, whether it's the idea of criminal activity that he might be held accountable for, or civil activity that he might be held accountable for, he's going to be desperate until the last moment, and he's going to be pulling all of this nonsense, which is the greatest threat that I have seen in my life to American democracy, the peaceful transference of power. It's just awful. Well, in any case, I've got a little bit of concern about the Supreme Court, too. As we all know, the American government is divided up into the three branches, the Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court. And when they put out an order, and we don't know who voted how or what the various roles were, it's terrible. I mean, we need to know that. And as far as I'm concerned, this is a despicable action on their part, not to say that they were united or not united, so that we as citizens have some sense as to where all of this is going and how much danger we have.
Chris Churchill.
Well, I don't think it was despicable. I mean, it was just a brief order saying we're not going to hear your case. They do that all the time. This was a long shot. I don't think too many people who follow the court very closely thought they were going to accept this case. It was kind of the expected thing. This was a case that involved a Pennsylvania law and whether it met the requirements of the Pennsylvania state constitution. That is not something the U.S. Supreme Court would really ever have any sort of role in deciding. And it just was never going to go anywhere. So I don't think the court exactly needed to say that, give any sort of explanation or give any sort of breakdown of the vote. And, you know, the more important thing is that, as I said, yesterday was Safe Harbor Day, which means the electoral college slates are pretty much locked into place. And the president is really running out of legal options at this point.
Right of reply, Joe?
Yeah, of course, yes.
Many of his supporters seem to think.
But. Right of reply.
Right of reply. With all due respect, you know that, Chris. Nobody has more respect for you than I do.
You feel that respect every moment of the day, don't you, Chris?
Yeah, the respect just shines through the phone.
It oozes. Yes.
But I do think that we need to know in this particular case. You're right. Under ordinary circumstances, it would just be a brief order. But in this case, this president of the United States has appointed people into the court. We need to know where they are. We need to know how close this whole thing is. We need to know what kind of dissonance or not lack of dissonance there is on the court. We'd love to know what John Roberts' role in all of this. I can only guess, that he's leader here. So I do think it's important that the more transparency, the better. And the court is coming around. I've always been one who thought that Supreme Court sessions should be on the air the moment they're on. Let everybody understand. I mean, if you can sit in the courtroom, why shouldn't you be able to watch it at home? Anyway, that's a long story, and I'm sure we'll return to it. And again, with great respect for you.
Bob. Well, go ahead. No, right of reply, Chris.
The thing I was going to say that if a few of the justices vigorously dissented, we would know about it, right? They would have written some. I realize this is comparing apples to oranges, but we had a case involving churches in New York State a few weeks ago and you had, you know, seven different opinions written or something like that. You know, every justice wanted to weigh in to give their take. And then this, when nobody says peep, I think we can probably assume that nobody really thought this case was warranted for the court.
Write a reply. with great respect.
Bob and Rosemary, we're never going to get to you, but go ahead.
With great respect, Chris, and to you, Rosemary, I can only say, I can only say that we should really know what these people are doing. And I think you can't have a transparent democracy without that. Anyway, okay, over to whoever goes next.
Yes, Bob, go ahead.
Yeah. So a couple points. And before anybody sends letters in, we do recognize that Pennsylvania is a commonwealth and not a state.
Yes.
So please don't flood our box.
Yes, we do.
And anytime we start a statement, with all due respect, typically there isn't any, but I will just note that that was very mature back and forth between Alan and Chris. You know,
civil, I respectful.
Actually,
yes.
Lincoln
Douglas.
Chris is much taller and younger than I am. I know where to go.
You know, I read the one sentence denial, and the one thing that did jump out at me was that there was no dissent noted. And you know, Alan, I don't disagree with you. I think the Supreme Court should be televised. I'm somebody who watches C-SPAN and gets great pleasure in even prime minister questions. I would love to watch the public proceedings of the Supreme Court. And I think any time that government can be more transparent, it's better for all of us. You know, the ruling, though, sort of builds off of the unanimous ruling from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And we're getting to the point of really frivolous lawsuits. And you know, one point that was made last week by one of the letter writers, which is spot on, was that, you know, the taxpayers are having to defend the state and local governments from this flood of absolutely ridiculous lawsuits that are only designed to curry favor with Trump and his minions. And at some point, I think we really do need to look at going back and seeing if we can recoup some of that money. If I could toss another twist into this, you know, I think it was also disgusting what the attorney general from Texas did, Paxton, filing a complaint against Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia. I mean, this is just grandstanding and using public taxpayers to do it, and really is unacceptable when we have so many other issues that we should be focusing on.
Before she goes to make cookies, Rosemary. Maybe she's already there.
So, no, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm a little bit frustrated because, for one thing, the court has never, ever issued a vote or dissents on cert. That's what this was, whether to take a case or not. The court has always not just given one ruling saying we take it or not, and it's because the entire court is speaking. It's like in a newspaper when you don't sign the editorial. It's because this is what the newspaper stands for. That's what the court stands for. The case that Chris is citing was an actual case, and in those cases, then dissents and votes are very important to know about, but not whether or not they're taking a case or not. That has always been something of a mystery. It's part of what keeps the court. You don't know if they're going to take it or not, and it's very difficult to get a case taken. This one from Texas is not going to go anywhere either. This case was never going to go anywhere. There have been more than 50 cases brought by Trump and his allies, his campaign allies across the country. Every one of them has been thrown out, to the point, not just thrown out, but with words of ridicule and threats of disbarring the lawyers who brought the cases. So why would the Supreme Court, even people appointed by Trump, take on a case that is utterly without merit? And the same with the Texas one, which is just ridiculous on the face of it. The Supreme Court is set up from the earliest days decide on fights between the states. But this is Texas, the Attorney General of Texas, saying Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and two other states did it wrong. There's no conflict between them. There's absolutely nothing there that will let the court say, yes, we'll take this case. And I think it was never a threat. I think the word that Bob used, grandstanding, is exactly what this has been from the beginning. And Teresa had it right yesterday. It's all part of Trump's effort to raise $200 million. But it was never a serious legal threat. What I think we need to do moving forward is to take a look at the electoral system that is set up, because Trump, if he did nothing else, he certainly didn't really threaten it, but he pointed out every little weakness and flaw in the system. And we ought to be really nervous now about the role of legislatures in intervening in elections. It didn't happen this time, but we sure saw how it could have happened. And that's the lesson here.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only correction, though, Rosemary, is that occasionally they do actually submit dissent, like Sotomayor has done it on a couple of occasions, but it is very, very rare. But it can happen, but typically it is the black box that you described it.
With all due respect,
it's hardly though a despicable act. I can't think of any time they did it. You may be right. No. I'll go look that up. But it hardly is a despicable act. It is the normal, and it is exactly what Trump should have gotten: an anonymous rejection for a ridiculous action. I liked it.
Yeah. With all due respect to the fabulous Rosemary, I really don't agree with that. I think that this democracy was on the verge of this guy pulling a bloodless coup. And when it comes to something like that, and it comes to the public interest understanding what this court is doing and why they're doing it, I think we can say it's always been this way. But there are times, and I think this is one of them, when the court owes us more than that. So there's a real difference of opinion between Rosemary and Alan.
All right.
And Chris. We should be happy. I agree with Rosemary. I mean, I think the curtness of what they did says something. You know, I think if we had learned that it was 6-3 or 7-2 or something like that, I mean, it would have been, the window's open a little bit, or maybe some of these future cases have success.
That's right.
I think the way that they did it so curtly and just almost dismissively, like, you know, get that out of here.
Yep.
Don't
make us laugh. Yeah, that's how they did it.
Exactly. And
if we had known the exact vote, we'd be sitting here parsing it, saying, "Oh, it's because Amy Coney Barrett did so and so, or
what's wrong with that?"
So no, they rejected it because it's legally lacking.
Well,
I know we're going into a break, Joe, but when we come back, I want to go to something that Alan said, you know, about the concern about violence. I mean, because I think we would be remiss if we don't raise what the Arizona Republican Party put out on social media. But I know we need to go to break.
Well, we do. I thank you for noting that. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to talk about. We have a great panel this morning. There's a lot of respect amongst the panelists, and we're going to put that on display once again after a short break. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters, you know, respectful as they may be, panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, and Bob Griffin. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Right before the break, we were talking about, Bob brought up the case, an issue that's happening in the state of Arizona, where a series of tweets was posted over the last 2 days by the Arizona Republican Party inciting violence and encouraging its supporters to give their lives in the effort to overturn the presidential results. The first tweet retweeted another user that said, "Stop the steal, which is a reference to the conservatives' theories that widespread voter fraud and election tampering handed Democratic President-elect Joe Biden the election. The user wrote, "I am willing to give my life for this fight." And then the state GOP retweeted that. Then the Republican Party in the state wrote, "He is, are you?" And then it sort of went downhill from there in another tweet. "This is what we do. This is who we are. Live for nothing or die for something." And then there is a photo with an arrow going pointed directly within an inch of a man's head. Bob.
It's so out of place in our society, and I usually don't feel like the Justice Department should be used in state matters, but in this situation, I really do think there needs to be investigation, and this is both inciting inciting violence and acts to undermine our democracy. But it's also a sign of really, you know, both how baseless and frankly evil some of the supporters of Trump in this absolutely discredited movement have become. The idea of falling back on violence, I mean, this has gone beyond from just being a sore loser to taking it to a whole new level. And frankly, it has no place in our society, and it should be investigated. And if folks are found guilty of violating any laws, they should be prosecuted.
I don't understand. I mean, this is obviously very serious, and I don't mean to be snarky, but so they're asking people to die over the fact that somebody else got more votes than their person did, right? I mean, is that's ultimately what we're talking about?
Yes.
Well, I mean, if you take what they're saying seriously and literally, it's, you know, they're talking about the sedition and the country's, you know, the democracy being taken over by international forces, and, you know, and I don't really want to give it any airtime, but
right.
I mean,
I understand.
I'm not going to say that it makes sense in that context, but that's kind of the context that they're dealing in. And this rhetoric is fairly widespread, at least on, you know, in social media. And, you know, it is troubling. I mean, I hope that this was just some dumb intern with access to the Twitter account and doesn't really reflect anything more substantial than that. There are a lot of Republicans in Arizona who immediately denounced the tweets. But, you know, it doesn't take much for some lunatic out there to start taking this stuff seriously and to do real damage. So I largely agree with Bob. It's troubling, and, you know, and ultimately, you know, Trump is responsible for this. He's not doing anything to discourage this kind of talk. He seems to be encouraging it, if anything. And it's just, I mean, there are a lot of Americans out there who still believe sincerely and firmly that this election is going to be overturned. And I'm not really sure what the reaction is going to be when it isn't, you know.
Rosemary?
Well, you know, it goes along with what he has done throughout his entire administration, encouraging division and violence and supporting people who react to disagreements with violence. The Rittenhouse case just stands out in my mind. Here's a young, really troubled, stupid kid who takes a gun and kills people because he disagrees with their point of view on police brutality. So he kills over it, and he's been turned into something of a hero on the right, which is just so messed up, so deeply messed up. And this whole thing about a civil war brewing among the divisions that he has helped to foment and to encourage hits me personally. I have sons who are getting taking gun lessons and buying weapons, and it terrifies me and makes me very unhappy. It's one of the reasons I keep talking about doom. I think this is a really bad trend, and I don't see anything that's stopping it, anything that's countering it. I think Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have a huge problem on their hands to try to bring us back together, because we have not been this far apart since maybe the 60s.
Yeah, and if I could jump in, and at first I need to compliment you on the sound effects, Rosemary. It was perfectly timed.
Yeah.
Cuckoo clock.
What sound effect?
There was a cuckoo clock.
Your cuckoo clock in your background.
You probably don't even hear it anymore.
Yeah, it was not a personal thing,
I don't.
Rosemary.
Yeah.
You know, Rosemary.
It's just that while you were talking, the cuckoo clock was going. You know, that was wrong. That was just wrong.
You're hitting on something that really does worry me, and going back to the type of political violence that we saw in the 1960s, you know, the type of violence that saw the assassinations of Martin Luther King, of the Kennedys, this brings back a huge concerns that I have for the well-being both of the democracy, but the people who are willing to serve in public positions. And what really bothers me is that it's getting not even to the sort of the leadership, you know, it's getting into people like Fauci and you know, civil servants who are just simply trying to be competent and do their job. And you're right. This all stems from a man baby who, for whatever reason, can't accept a loss.
Well, some of the Republicans in the House who are being silent about this effort are the people who should know, who know most what this could lead to. I mean, some of them were at a softball game a few years ago that was, you know, shot up. They, you know,
Steve Scalise, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we don't have to go back to the 60s to find examples of how you know, political rhetoric can lead to violence. It's I try to be the optimist on this show most of the time, but I am worried about the next few weeks. I will say that.
Let's go to a couple of letters from listeners, and then we'll take a break in a moment. Howard says, "Will Trump run a shadow presidency, and what might that mean on the continuum of awfulness?"
Yes, he will. I was thinking yesterday.
Well,
sorry to jump in so quickly, but that's been on my mind. I think, you know, the $200 million that he has raised off this, which I think is one of the biggest financial scams in maybe American history. I mean, you claim that you're raising money for a legal fight, and then you don't use the money for that legal fight. It's outrageous. But that money will allow him to be kind of a shadow president, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if he announces that he's running for president in 2024, you know, the day of Joe Biden's inauguration or the day after. And I think that we've talked in this show about, you know, how much attention should the media pay him over the next 4 years. Well, if he's the next Republican nominee, then that, you know, it almost kind of guarantees that he gets a fair amount of attention.
Alan, did you want to say, or Bob?
You know,
go ahead.
Do you want to go first, Bob? Go ahead.
No, I'll just jump in real quick. You're right. It's one of the worst Ponzi schemes we've ever seen. The fact that people continue to contribute, you know, their life savings to a failed multimillionaire is just dumbfounding to me. I still contend that in 4 years, you know, Trump will not be a player. My crystal ball is saying that he's either going to be in so much legal jeopardy or there will be health issues. I do think that he's going to try but not succeed to continue to hold the GOP party hostage.
Now, this is one of the reasons why the appointment of an independent attorney general becomes so important. Biden has said two things. He's not interested in going after Trump on a national level. But on the other hand, he said he wants to appoint an attorney general who will be his own person and will do what he thinks the law demands. And then we go to Cyrus Vance in New York City and Letitia James, the attorney general in New York, both of whom have cases. Maura Healey, the AG in Massachusetts, and he's going to have his hands full. And I believe no person is above the law, and therefore, if there are grounds for prosecution, they should do it. And one more thing, we all get very difficult mail. I've had a lot of difficult mail over the years, and I have always put it in a particular file in case the police ever need to see it. Nevertheless, the idea is that a lot of the people who I used to dismiss as just being, you know, nutty, are now taking that Kool-Aid, which may lead them to a very bad place, and that's worrisome.
Yeah, Alan, can I ask you a question? Do you think that this is just a small minority that's being amplified because of the way media and particularly social media works right now, or do you think the movement is larger? That's something I struggle with because I just can't get a grip on it.
Well, we know what the numbers are. They're frightening. 72 million Americans voted for Trump.
this but not is everybody a... who voted for Trump is advocating violence. That's what I was trying to sort
no,
of
oh,
tease
I see
out
what you mean. Yeah. Right. Oh, no. And let's remember, Bob, it doesn't take more than one, you know, crazy person with a gun to do what Sirhan allegedly did, you know, or each of these people. You know, they come out and we've lost some very fine, wonderful public servants because of this. And so I'm concerned. I really am. Yeah.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters. We have more to discuss on this topic and others. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Wednesday morning. Let's go back to some letters. We have this from Audrey. I have to say, our politician can take a lesson or two from this morning's panel. This is civil discourse where people disagree and argue their points with facts and respect rather than attacks. With that, Rosemary is right. Plus, can you imagine how mad Trump is not knowing if his nominee supported his case?
Bob was right. There are times when the surge votes do garner either agreement or dissent when the justices want to make a statement. But at any rate, what we know is this. In order to get cert, you have to have at least four votes. That means Trump only got three votes at most to hear his case. And they weren't so strong that anybody wanted to speak out and say, we're making a grievous mistake not taking this case. So no matter how you cut it, no matter how he looks at it, the people he put on the court did not support him.
Yeah, yes, and I'd be willing to bet he got...
Well, go ahead, Chris, and then Bob.
Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
I'd be willing to bet he got zero votes, too. I mean, I just the case was so dubious and so wrong for the Supreme Court that I would be surprised if anyone went along with it.
Bob.
Yep, I agree.
But you don't know. But you don't know. You know, you'd be willing to bet, but you don't know.
We don't know.
And we're always
like Rosemary said, if there was somebody who felt strongly enough who wanted the dissent and really felt strongly about it, they would make their opinion known, right? We would know about it if they objected strongly.
There's so much that we don't know. I mean, you got John Roberts there, obviously trying to lead that court into a realm of sanity. But we do know that when you're talking about Alito, when you're talking about Clarence Thomas and some of the others, it really is something that you can't decide that you know the answer to about how what they were doing or what they were saying. I've studied the Supreme Court all my life, and I've studied the process of cert. Thanks, Rosemary. And I do know that it is a way of doing things. But as we have seen, there are times in the history of this country that we really need to know what's happening. So if it was a 4-3 or whatever it was, 5-4, we should know that because it tells us a great deal about where this crucial top-level institution is.
It's almost, though, as if you're asking for the court to become activists, which is the court saying this is such an extraordinary case where the president has taken on the electoral system that we're going to tell you what we think. That in itself would make it stand out in a way this court does not and cannot afford to take action. It wants business as usual. And as for why the court didn't take the case, I think the words of every Supreme Court and lower at the state level and lower court in the federal level that saw these 50 cases before they came up to the Supreme Court said it well, that voting in this country is decided by the ballot, it's decided by voters, and it's not decided by verdicts and judges. And that's the court doesn't need to say anything else. Trump has been soundly rebuked.
Well,
and
now
remember that Alito wrote this one line declaration, which kind of made me feel a little bit better about it because you're right. I mean, he's been on some strange sides of decisions.
Alan?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you've heard me. You've heard what I have to say. The Supreme Court has a huge role because in the end, when everything else is contested, that court is making up its mind. And the American people need to know who's on the court and what they're saying. It's that simple.
But I think the important thing is that they decided in this
with this that they're not going to have a huge role. I mean, they're not going to even hear the case. They're not going to issue an injunction. They allowed Safe Harbor Day to, you know, to go forward with Pennsylvania fully included. They were stepping back and saying, we're not part of this. This case has nothing to do with us.
And since you have such a great insight, and I mean that respectfully, Chris, into that court, could you tell me how many people voted for or against it? This decision.
I've already said I would bet that zero did, and then the fact that Alito wrote it makes me even more confident that zero voted for it.
Yes.
And you know, we may know at some point. It may leak out. It may leak out.
All right, let's go back to the letters. We go to Oscar, who says an impeached president should not be allowed to run for the same office again. Kara said back when Stone was pardoned.
By the way, you'd have to you know, change the Constitution to do that. It's a fair letter, but you would have to amend the Constitution. Right?
Kara, yeah. Well, I mean, and he wasn't, I mean, he was not removed from office. He was only by one, right? So by one house.
Right. He wasn't convicted.
But not convicted.
I mean, that would be, to say that he couldn't run for office would be like saying someone who was accused of a crime but found not guilty couldn't do certain things. It wouldn't make much sense.
Nope.
Kara said, back when Stone was pardoned, I asked Alan what he thought Stone would do to help Trump get reelected. The response was that he would stay quiet. I think if you look back on the 2016 election, the slogan, Stop the Steal, was introduced. It was put up by a PAC to raise money. I think a lot of what is being done is not only a fundraising opportunity, but a strategy of Stone and Roy Cohn. That being, never give up, and hate plays better than love.
I agree with the letter, even though it takes some, it looks into what I may have said, because I sure don't remember it. It doesn't much matter. What does matter is that that we are faced with this conundrum of a guy who is not giving up on his and by the way, and Roger Stone, of course, I have nothing good to say about. And so, you know, the idea that I would say to you, he'll keep shut and he won't ever say another word, doesn't talk about who this guy is.
Chris says the dismissal is oh so satisfying. It's one more step towards irrelevance and oblivion for the bloviating blowhard. He'll keep making noise after he's gone, but it will be ignored, we hope. We go to...
No, he's that's... Can I just say
absolutely.
That is a pipe dream. The pipe dream. He's raising money. He will be in opposition. He will be given a courtroom. It's another stage for him. And you forget all of the spawn of the devil that's out there now from Ivanka. a major story yesterday on what she'll do next. And his idiot sons and Pence and Nikki Haley. This is far, far from over. It's like you've wiped out one spot, but it's already oozed out, and the swamp is back.
Well, I agree, but what if he's in jail?
Again, a courtroom and his lawyers. He's expert at using his lawyers to get his point out, and his children will go visit him. We'll have stories about what he's spewing from jail. Prisons, I almost am willing to bet he's not going to end up in jail, even if he is charged, even if he does end up going to court, even if it does go against him, he won't do any time. We don't put rich, powerful people in this country in jail. It's so rare that I think that I would have a safe bet.
And Rosemary, you're on to something. That, you know, the misuse weaponization of the justice system by Trump is something that really needs to be looked at. And I find it fascinating. I don't know if we're going to get a chance to talk about the whole McConnell stimulus issue, but it's interesting to me that Congress is actually trying to deny people access to the very courts to bring actual lawsuits forward.
Yep.
But they support the frivolous use of the court system to appease Trump because they lack the backbone to stand up to him.
Let's see. Gerard says, read between the lines. The justice's lack of comment is a strong statement in and of itself. Claire says, with all due respect, Alan's desire for the Supreme Court to behave differently towards anything involving Trump spits in the face of the fundamental basis the court sits on. The court is in premise above politics. Their clout lies in their history of maintaining poise and continuing to function in the same way regardless of the case before them or the president in the White House.
Then how come Trump's getting a majority on the court the way that he has right now transcends politics? You really believe that? Because it doesn't. You're just wrong.
Mark says, while I appreciate and desire transparency in the Supreme Court, please also consider that Trump has successfully inspired violence and death threats against those serving in government that oppose him. Wouldn't he do the same with Supreme Court judges in his increasing desperate attempts to disenfranchise American voters? Is it wise for the court to make themselves targets in these times? Well, that's an interesting point.
Well, yes, but a lot of people have come to the point where, you know, they have risked everything, their lives, their reputations, their jobs, in order to preserve the democracy. So, you know, I think that's something to be remembered here, including the court.
Yeah, and I think if you're on the Supreme Court, you're used to being in the middle of very controversial and you know, emotional issues. I'm sure that they get kind of scary threats all the time. That wouldn't be anything new.
Julius says, but what about the Texas lawsuit? SCOTUS has asked for replies from the states, so accused by tomorrow at 3 p.m.
Say that again.
Yeah, I mean.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, this is about the Texas lawsuit.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that.
So they were saying that what about the Texas lawsuits? They have asked for replies by tomorrow at 3 p.m.
There's no way that case is going to fly. It's just so silly. The only person pushing it is Hannity. No way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just an attempt to, because of the way that, you know, I think it was Article 3, where if one state sues another, it goes to the Supreme Court. It's just a kind of a feeble attempt to get this to the court. And the only way that they can think of, or Paxton at least can think of, to do it. But I just don't think there's anything there. I mean, I think it's going to be another curt dismissal.
Yeah. I don't think Paxton thinks it's going to go anywhere. I think what he's doing is he's buying free publicity for himself because he thinks it'll set him up to run for governor of Texas.
All right.
Well, and
go ahead.
I was going to say Paxton has, if anybody's following what's happening with him, he's got plenty of legal issues and all sorts of kind of controversy around him. I mean, he's a guy who's probably looking to change the subject a little bit.
And Marjorie, last letter before the break, Marjorie writes, it should be lost on no one that the people encourage, applauding, inciting violence over a free and fair election result are probably the same people who ranted over the looting and violence after the murders of black people by white people. Thanks for listening, Marjorie. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo all on the show today. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. I want to go to like two letters and then I want to move over to some other issues here. One letter that we got is from Larry, who said in the small number of people who were vaccinated yesterday in Britain, there were two adverse reactions and a warning has been issued. The emergency use authorizations must be viewed very carefully or there will be a failure of trust if adverse reactions continue to mount.
Yeah, I saw that. That is very disheartening and very, very important. In fact, I think a warning just came out for anybody with significant allergies to be cautious with taking the shots. Also, Joe, this isn't unexpected. I mean, this is part of the part of the balance between trying to get a vaccine into usage with what we usually have as a gold standard of safety.
Right.
Well, you know, gold standard, I have to say, from a personal perspective, you know, I got stung by a bee and ended up in the hospital. I know that, and I carry the EpiPen, or I was supposed to anyway. But on the other hand, I'd rather not die. And if the choice is between, you know, getting the shot with appropriate precautions and dying. You know, to me, there's no choice here. You know, we've got to get around this. But
yeah.
I think an awful lot of people have this.
Well, I understand. I mean, the concern, of course, is that in the rush to get it to market, that the list of concerns has perhaps not been fully compiled.
Well, you know, Joe, that may be. Nevertheless, think of how many people are dying every day. I mean, it seems to me we've really got to proceed as fast as we possibly can, and some risk is acceptable considering the amount that we have tested up to this time.
Yeah, 2,597 passed just yesterday from COVID, and there was over 220,000 new cases. So the spread of this is not slowing down.
Let's go.
We have people who won't even wear masks for the good of others to keep the spread down. So to ask them to have a needle stuck in your arm that they took a really fast time bringing to market is asking for way more than I think most people are going to give. They have to make sure this thing is safe. I don't think there's any hope otherwise of getting people to get vaccinated.
Well, isn't that a matter of individual choice, respectfully, Rosemary, that each of us has to make up our mind about
that? And what we're seeing is that too many people are choosing not even to wear a mask, which is a lot easier to do than to get a needle stuck in you.
Mm. Well, I agree. I agree with that.
All right, let's go to this. I just wanted to go to the story about hospital capacity, and let's talk about this a bit. Intensive care beds are nearing capacity across the country, according to new data. When you look at the map, the New York Times has a map, an analysis of from the Department of Health and Human Services data, and showing the patient counts across the country. You know, and just comparing it, I'm going to say the obvious here, I think, but comparing it to the maps earlier, very early in the pandemic, where there were splotches in certain spots in New York and in New Jersey, and then on the West Coast and in Louisiana and a couple hot spots. Now the country is just almost awash, and with very few exceptions. So now that places that have 400 intensive care beds are out, do not have any. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, for example, there were no intensive care beds at all. And they need them. Hospitals serving more than 100 million Americans reported having fewer than 15% of intensive care beds still available as of last week, according to a Times analysis of data reported by hospitals and released by the Department of Health and Human Services. Many areas are even worse off. 1 in 10 Americans across a large swath of the Midwest, South, and Southwest lives in an area where intensive care beds are either completely full or fewer than 5% of beds available. At these levels, experts say maintaining existing standards of care for the sickest patients may be difficult or impossible. Alan, I listened to your interview yesterday with the governor and was taken. This seems to be the main issue on his radar right now is hospitals and what they're able to withstand at this point.
And not only that, but he's made it clear that it's going to lie with him to adjudicate whether or not hospitals with fewer patients are asked, for example, Mount Sinai, he named specifically, as I remember it, are named to accept patients from, let's say, Buffalo. That's a hell of a power, but it's terribly important.
Bob?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers, I think we're just starting to see the post-Thanksgiving surge. When you look at you know, you put out some really scary figures, Joe, but there's even worse, you know, that, you know, if you look at places like Amarillo or Troy, Michigan, or Coral Gables, Florida, we're talking across the country, that rates are approaching what New York City had at its absolute peak. This isn't this isn't slowing down, and yet you continue to see unacceptable behavior and advice coming from the Trump administration, the politicization of masks. The couple points that I'll toss to folks to think about. One of the things that the State Department of Health did early on in the pandemic, which was brilliant, is that they were able to shift resources from upstate to downstate, particularly the city. So they were actually able to bring in a surge of like 30,000 healthcare workers to help with that, with the surge. Now there is no surge capacity left. If you think about it, it is so widespread, and it's through so many communities that we don't have the ability to shift resources the way that we did, and I fear that we're going to continue to see spikes, and I still am very, very concerned about the end of December and midway through January.
Rosemary.
Wow. 70% of Republicans approve of the way Trump has handled the COVID crisis. And here we are. So this is something that has been warned about. This was the whole idea of flattening the curve. It has happened. It has rolled out exactly as the public health experts that Rand Paul and others have ridiculed, have predicted that it would. And we're here. We're now going to see what happens. And there was a time before I, grew up, before I actually became a journalist, when I was only thinking about it, when I would almost hope for this most outrageous of occurrences to happen, that it would go to the final end, just so you could see what happened, like the hurricane that would really strike in the middle of a Florida at category 5. And it's perverse. And of course, something that I shouldn't even be admitting to now, but we're actually here. And there was always something that held back. The hurricane didn't strike, or it struck, but people had been warned and got away. And here we knew what was coming. We were told what to do, and we didn't. And we just keep supporting the people who have said, oh, it'll just disappear by Easter. And here we are. And it's just, people do not deserve this, but some of them asked for it. And it's just fascinating for me to watch this, I have to say. And the other thing that I really, again, have this feeling of anger, the New York Times is writing about that today. What do you do with these misplaced feelings of the anger that we've come to this? But Rob DeSantis in Florida, who supported everything Trump did, who made that state really a death trap right now. My son is there now. My daughter-in-law, future daughter-in-law, is in the hospital, not for COVID, but for something else, but she's exposed to COVID. People I know are being affected by his bad governance, and he sent the state police to go in and ransack the home and hold a gun on the children of a public health official who is only trying to help us help ourselves. What is wrong with Americans? This all makes me wonder.
Yeah, that's a terrifying case that absolutely deserves review by the Biden Department of Justice and their Civil Rights Division. The idea of going in with guns
at the video, Bob?
Yeah, they
that was amazing.
I want to hear your view on that.
Yeah, it was a question of if she misused the some state data
government
or
equipment.
State equipment, right? But the idea government of going equipment. in
right.
with guns drawn in that situation, that all that was an effort to stifle people who disagree with what's going on. I mean, this is the absolute worst case example in misuse of police powers. And frankly, I think that the officers who were involved in that, they should be investigated, including the command staff who allowed them
charged.
To go in.
Yeah, that's what I was going to.
Yep.
Do you guys believe the governor who said I had absolutely nothing to do with this, nothing in a tweet?
No, I do not. I do not. I definitely do not. The whole case was he shut her down because she was saying, hey, we're going to have an explosion of cases here. It's out of control. He wanted her to lie. She refused, so he fired her. And then she goes off on her own and sends out alternative bits of information. He accused her of using state equipment and soliciting information from state employees. And the truth is, she was getting information from state employees, but she wasn't using state equipment to get it. And they wanted her to have it because too many people do want the truth out. So they invade her home looking for equipment that belonged to the state and passwords that she supposedly had illicitly. And of course, the case is now against her has been dropped because there was nothing to it.
Mm.
It's such a setup. And really, I mean, I use her as a stand-in for all the people who are dying and not getting checks that they should, because not only is there bad governance here, this is evil and malicious government going on.
Yeah, and while no charges were levied against her, the trauma that she experienced and that malaise that it puts over anybody who wants to call government out for bad behavior, which frankly I think is a hallmark of both our free press and our constitutional rights, have been significantly impacted. I mean, these are the steps that lead to authoritarianism, and whoever is involved in this absolutely deserves to be prosecuted.
Chris Churchill.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with the Florida case, but going back to the ICU beds, I mean, it's an example of how one public health crisis can lead to another. I mean, obviously,
yep.
those beds are needed by people who have, you know, full ranges of medical conditions and emergencies. And if those beds aren't available, you know, you see deaths that aren't directly attributable to COVID, but are COVID caused, right?
And Chris, what do you think about Albany Med? I'm having a really hard time being unsympathetic to nurses at this time.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's something I have. I mean, the fact that they had a little one day strike in the middle of this is really telling and really says really remarkable. But I don't know. It's hard for me to know because on the one hand, the natural inclination is to side with the nurses, given all that they've been going through. On the other hand, we read that a lot of hospitals are in deep financial trouble, and obviously we can't have them, you know, going under or being forced to make cuts right now. So I really don't, I don't know. I mean, in a way, it brings me back to what we kind of started talking about, which is the College of St. Rose and some of the cuts they were forced to make. I mean, the pandemic and the economic kind of after effects are just rippling through all sorts of areas. And I know the St. Rose had financial issues before the pandemic, but it sure seems that this has not helped.
No.
Yeah. And my concern is that the pandemic will be used as an excuse to permanently lower our quality of life and what people are being paid. And you know, if you think about it, the very wealthy are continuing to make even more wealth off of this situation. Which leaves the rest of us in a very untenable position. But I think part of the long-term consequences that we haven't really talked about is what it means for our individual paychecks. And it is being used as an excuse to reduce wages. And unfortunately, when wages go down, they typically don't bounce back.
No, that's such a great point that we're just the excuse, and yet, and I certainly understand what you're saying, but there's also the reality too, right? I mean, there is the real numbers and the real problems that are happening.
There is. I mean, I'll throw some stones back at the federal government, but this is why the diddling on the stimulus package, the efforts to undermine stimulus back to to individual citizens versus corporations. That the idea that there hasn't been any movement to at least suspend the tax giveaway that was done as part of the Trump tax breaks. There are things that we could have done as a people and government to cushion the overall economy and Main Street's economy that have not been taken. And I certainly hope that Yellen comes in and is actually able to make some of the changes, although I fear that they've really reduced the number of tools that she has.
Alan?
Well, I'm enjoying the conversation, to be perfectly honest with you. I think you've all made...
But don't you want to be part of it?
No. You know, usually if I have something to disagree with, as you all know, I will do it. But, you know, I think the conversation makes great sense.
All right. Let's go to I want to go to another story, and that is because Bob just brought it up about the stimulus talks. White House offering $916 billion stimulus proposal, cutting jobless benefits. The proposal by Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, was the administration's first substantive engagement with Congress on a stimulus deal since the election. Jump-starting negotiations with days to spare, the White House on Tuesday offered Democrats a $916 billion pandemic stimulus proposal that would meet their demand to provide some relief to state and local governments and include liability protections for businesses that have been a top priority of Republicans. The offer from Mnuchin to Speaker Nancy Pelosi was the first time since November's elections that the Trump administration has engaged directly in talks on Capitol Hill about how to prop up the nation's flagging economy. It came as lawmakers raced to reach a deal on another round of coronavirus relief before they conclude this year's session, now expected to happen next week. The plan does not include a proposed revival of $300 weekly enhanced employment benefits, though it would extend other federal unemployment programs set to expire in the coming weeks. Instead, it would include another smaller round of direct payments to Americans amounting to $600 a person. The original $2.2 trillion stimulus law enacted in March distributed a round of $1,200 stimulus checks and established the enhanced unemployment benefits at $600 a week through July. But as we all know, of course, Bob, since July, things got much better.
Yeah, I mean, talk about the Grinches that stole
Christmas. Sarcasm alert.
Yeah, I mean, this is so disturbing to me. And what McConnell was proposing is that he would trade funding for state and local government aid for individual aid. And to me, it's not an either or. It has to be both.
And you better believe that the president, and you better believe, Bob, that the president is sitting there up on the White House with his finger on this whole thing and telling McConnell what he will or will not accept. And the one thing that we know that Andrew Cuomo, for example, is, and so many other governors are adamant about, is some real substantial help for the state and local governments. And the governors, of course, including the Republican governors of these states, are adamant about getting that help because they're all underwater. Yet those governors and the president of the United States may have some real dissonance in them. But what do you do? I mean, if you're seeing these Republican cultists supporting the president no matter what, and you're a Republican politician, what do you vote for?
Yeah, and I fear that Trump is you know, as he's continuing to throw his tantrum, that he views this as a way of punishing everybody that didn't vote for him.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I think that does play a huge role in it. And again, where does that come from? It comes from just watching what he's done since the election. It's watching him spend more time on the golf course than he has in COVID briefings. I mean, just the pattern of neglect is stunning. And again, we talked about the numbers, the number of deaths per day, the number of new cases, and you know, he's fiddling and we're burning.
Yeah, I just can't
figure out what their thinking is to deny people when the need is so obvious and when the cost. It's a significant cost if you look at it just as the outlay, but all that money that they would put into relief would immediately come back in the form of payments and purchases. It's so good for the economy. It's really hard for me to see what the positive is in denying it, unless it's like to hurt Joe Biden, that his first month in office, people are going to be evicted, out of work, unable to eat, facing cold weather without security, no jobs. That's pandemonium. I just can't make myself think that even Mitch McConnell is wishing that on Americans. What is the thinking?
Chris?
I don't know the answer to that question, but, you know, it was kind of portrayed as the president as being kind of engaged in this, and my impression is that he's not engaged in this at all, and he could really care less about it. Right. I don't think he's gonna punish Republicans who vote one way or the other. I don't think he cares about this. Which is not obviously is to his discredit. It's he obviously should be cared. But I think one thing I've argued for a long time now is that this doesn't have to be done all at once. This doesn't have to be one massive package. You can break it up and get the things done that everyone tends to agree need to be done. You know, get immediate relief out there and then argue about the more difficult parts later, or even maybe when the new administration comes in.
So which of the difficult parts, for example, state and local aid, is that what you're saying?
If that's holding up relief that people desperately need, then yeah, I think you wait until January on that, or whatever might be holding it up. There's always this desire to get these things done in huge packages, and a lot of times the reason they do that is so they can stuff them full of goodies that, you know, that are kind of tucked away in there and nobody sees, and you're kind of obligated to vote for it for the greater good. But I think the need is so desperate right now. There's an emergency out there, and I think they need to get the money out there as quickly as they can. And if that means sacrificing things that still do need to be done, but just can't be done right away, then I think you go ahead and do that.
All right, we have to pause for a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with our panel. Last call before we move on and finish up the panel segment. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo, we do welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. We'll continue with letters and new topics after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I knew this was going to happen, and I'm glad that it did, but here we are. When Rosemary mentioned the nurses at Albany Med, the nurses have written. The nurses at Albany Med have been fighting for patient safety for years. Do not diss them, says Susan. Then Linda says, nurses do not like going on strike, but they are pushed to do it for valid reasons. As a nurse manager, I have seen the unwillingness of senior leaders to negotiate so that other staff will not unionize. Boards of directors need to decrease the salaries of over 300,000 management in hospitals so that frontline workers and therefore patients can get the resources, human and material, that they need. Rosemary. Or Chris,
do you? I don't think either one of us was intending to dismiss the nurses or diss them or dismiss
the
their
opposite.
Concerns.
My comment was it's hard for me to not be sympathetic to them, and especially I'm not hearing anything from management that justifies letting nurses go out at this time. This has been a 2-year battle. And I understand those financial problems, but I bet the nurses know that too. And it just seems hard to me to understand how they could let it go to this in the middle of a pandemic.
And who deserves protection more than our nurses and our hospital workers? It's easy for all of us to project ourselves into this, but in all honesty, these are the great heroes of this pandemic.
Time Magazine is making them Persons of the Year, Alan. Did you see that?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And they deserve to be treated well, extraordinarily well. Sorry, many of us are not putting ourselves online the way that they are. And, I find it very hard not to believe that when they insist and have to make a point the way they did, it wasn't a 50-day strike. It was a one-day strike. And I'm sure there was some coverage.
Well, it was coverage. And my question, we got this letter from Ann who says that Albany Medical Center is not in financial difficulty. They can afford a piddly 3% raise to their nurses. We have been negotiating for 2.5 years. They paid the scab nurses $100 per hour. Many of the scab nurses were from the I never thought I'd be saying the word scab nurses, by the way, were from the South and brought more COVID with them. Things are not great there. That's Ann apparently from the front line. But it does bring up the question of how do you, because my thought on the story all along has been, why from a standpoint, yes, it seems very much the nurses deserve this, and God knows they deserve it. And just from a public relations standpoint, as the nation is standing up and is, as Rosemary said, and applauding our frontline workers, and they're the people of the year, why would you not, and why would you turn around and not negotiate with them in a fairer way, I guess, is my question.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hard to figure out. Okay.
It does, but Joe, if I could just jump in with something I said earlier, because this is one of my concerns, is that COVID and the pandemic is going to be used as an excuse to defend undermining, things like pay and safety standards. And I'm really concerned about when I'm reading about what McConnell's talking about in the stimulus package, the idea of eliminating people's access to the courts for safety violations from companies. They're using the crisis to push through changes in labor laws that they could never push through on a normal basis.
So let's talk a little bit about McConnell. What is concerning you there? You've brought it up, and I have not gone back. So talk about your concerns and where we are in that.
Well, my concern is that, again, we're not seeing the type of bipartisanship that we should. I think it feels to me like there has been a significant move away from the forward progress. I use the term the Grinch's that's still Christmas. This Congress should not go out of session until they approve a stimulus package. And to me, they should approve a stimulus package that is well beyond the veto threat, because the president is tossing around veto threats left and right in crazy ways. And at sort of its heart, I'm having a hard time understanding how they can't be, when I say they, I mean Congress particularly in the Senate. Can't be more empathetic and supportive of the people in this country who are suffering. And instead, what I'm starting to see is the rhetoric that I was concerned about, that all of a sudden the Senate is going to adopt, a fiscal responsibility that they have absolutely categorically denied and ignored for the past 4 years. And this is where I get upset, is it's not time to play politics as usual. We're not through this. And well, you're making the situation worse. Sorry, Alan.
No, that's okay. It's easy, respectfully, it's easy for you to say that. But the problem is that McConnell wants to be the leader, right? We agree on that, right, Bob?
Right.
He wants to be the leader. And he'll do anything to keep that personal prerogative, including not passing a bill with Democratic help with the people in his conference who he needs. So his whole thing has been, if I can't just pass it with the members of my conference, I'm not going to do it. That is irresponsible. It's hateful when you consider what's at stake here.
Yeah, and it's spineless. I mean, and spineless for people who, anybody in the Senate who is elected to represent their constituents and instead fall into line with a really partisan position rather than what's good for their constituents. It is really frustrating.
I don't even get that, Bob. Bob, I don't get that. What's the partisan position that McConnell is pushing? How is this good for Republicans to not have a stimulus agreement?
It isn't good for Republicans, and I think that's this Georgia race kind of is one reason I still think that they'll get something done, because I think that the two Republican candidates there will pay a price if nothing does get done.
And Rosemary, to add to your confusion, I can't answer the question because it's so mind-boggling to me. But when you look at other crises that the country has faced. We saw Congress come together and show both stateship and craftsmanship and true leadership, and I think they've failed miserably in this situation.
Yeah, they really have. I keep trying to figure out what his strategy is, though. How does it help? McConnell wants power. How does it help him retain power to make Americans suffer? Americans who vote for him and for many of his other people, including those in Georgia that he wants to keep in. How does this help them? He wants to make Pelosi look bad. He wants to make Joe Biden and the new administration look bad. And that could work. But boy, that's really cynical.
Well, don't you think, who
don't like him at all, have trouble with that.
Mm. Well, but don't you think his problem is not what he wants or what he thinks is right, Rosemary, but that he's got several very conservative, very Republican-type people who say not another penny to help the people. That's what they believe. That's what this is, a part of the Orthodox Republican, thinking on all of this. And he just won't.
Do you think there's a majority of the U.S. Senate who thinks that way?
No, you're exactly right. And
McConnell, it seems to me, just has to put it to a vote and it would go through.
Of course, but he's always eschewed that. He won't do it. He won't pass a bill with Democratic votes. It has to be, and that's a part of his thinking, the way that he goes forward, which is, if I can't have just Republicans passing this bill, I don't want any part of it, even though it would be helpful to the American people and all those people without any food on their tables.
Yeah, and as people are dying, it becomes even more of a hollow game to me, and I do believe that this is part of his longer term plan to try to make sure that the Democratic administration can't put their agenda in place because he's going to starve them of both appointments and money.
And when it comes to autocracy, because that's what this is. Here is a McConnell saying, I'm going to superimpose my will. For example, Obama appoints a Supreme Court justice. It would have gone sailing through if there would have been a vote.
Right.
But there was no vote.
Yeah.
And there was no vote on the other 173 other judicial appointments either, Alan. I mean, he
exactly.
the reason they're crowing about the Trump success in the court is because he blocked not just the Supreme Court, but all of the other lesser federal courts as well.
Yeah.
And also what's going on right now is that McConnell and Trump are colluding to stop the defense bill, which has ruled the country for, decades. And that also is in danger right now. I guess Trump is off ordering a veto. The House has passed it with a veto-proof majority. But we don't know what's happening in the Senate. I don't get it. What is the advantage to the Republicans to mess up everything when people need this stuff? They need an army and they need money so that they can live. That's pretty basic.
Yeah. And for those of you that are wondering what Rosemary's talking about, Trump is threatening to veto the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the one bill that has to be passed every year because it is absolutely linked to our national security. Part of the reason that Trump is saying that he wants to veto it is because he's trying to protect the Confederate names on army bases. Yeah.
He wants to strike out at tech companies too. He would
right. It was a strike. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was after the whole diaper Donnie hashtag. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's another example of how his personal tantrum and immaturity is continuing to permeate its way through all of government right now. But the NDAA
and it appears that McConnell's
signed.
Going along with it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just not sure. The NDAA I do still hold out hope that the NDAA will be passed. Yeah, it's such a game right now.
Meanwhile, we have heard from Time Magazine, who wants us to know that their readers' poll has named the frontline workers, essential workers, as the persons of the year. The magazine itself has not yet named.
Ah, Yeah, that's
no. We certainly urge Time magazine to adopt what the readers are telling them is important. Then let me endorse.
So there's a little asterisk next to. We just wanted to clear that up, and we thank the magazine for being in touch with us. Let's see. We're out of time. I was going to say we have a couple of minutes, but we don't. We have about 40 seconds. So that's time enough for me to thank the group and for your contributions this morning. Alan, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you.
Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo, I thank you all, and we will be back with the Congressional Corner right after this short break.